Back in December, in Paris, nearly 200 countries committed themselves to curbing greenhouse gases. This hour, the challenges here in Iowa of realizing cleaner energy. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Today we imagine the future of cleaner energy, including low-cost ways to capture the nation's burgeoning wind and solar energy, and an Iowa town working towards energy independence by 2030. My guests, former Obama advisor Heather Zeichel, Robert Brown, who leads ISU's next-generation fuel technology, and the former director of the Iowa Energy Center, Kevin Nordmeyer. Iowa's role in a cleaner energy future. First, this news. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. By the end of the Paris talks on climate change last year, only back in December, 195 countries agreed on a pact that commits both rich and poor countries to curb their greenhouse gas emissions, transitioning away from fossil fuel dependence. However, global cooperation is only the first step. It's up to all of us to address the challenge and accomplish what has been pledged at an international level. So how are we addressing this challenge in Iowa? This hour, we imagine the future of clean energy in this part of the world, including low-cost ways to capture the nation's burgeoning wind and solar energy. We know Iowa's a big leader in wind energy, and store it for later use. Also, technologies that remove or store carbon dioxide. And a little later in the hour, we'll hear about an Iowa town, Bloomfield, in southern Iowa, working towards complete energy independence by the year 2030. And we want to have you join us this hour with your comments. Perhaps your activities. Are you actively pursuing cleaner energy in your community, in your household, in your business? You can tell us about it this hour, 1-866-780-9100. Tweet us at IPR Talk. Find Iowa Public Radio on Facebook. Joining us to start off this conversation, Heather Zeichel is with us, a senior fellow at the Atlantic Council, also former top advisor to President Obama on clean energy and climate change, joining us by phone. Hello, Heather.
Good morning.
It's afternoon here, so good afternoon to you. Good morning. Good day, I guess we can say, to get both of those. Also with us, Robert Brown, professor of mechanical engineering and director of the Bioeconomy Institute at Iowa State University in Ames. He's in our Ames studio. Professor Brown, thank you for joining us. We'll get those technical aspects. I heard you very faintly, Robert. I think we'll get you fixed there in just a moment. But in the meantime, let me mention the event that you and Heather are taking part in, an event in Des Moines this evening that features a discussion of the future of energy. Not only that, but also some beer and live music. It's presented by the Des Moines Register and USA Today Network. It is kicking off USA Today's One Nation series of forums across the country on topics shaping the presidential election from 5 until 9 this evening, with a panel discussion at 6. This is at Woolies on Locust Street in Des Moines. And Heather, let me start off with you. Give us a preview of what you want to make a point of saying later today.
Well, again, thank you for the opportunity to join you. And as an Iowa native, I'm very excited to be back home. But I'm also really excited about the role that Iowa is playing in transitioning to a clean energy economy. The state of Iowa has been a national wind energy leader, and all of their work to support that industry has actually allowed the state to, you know, continue to maintain affordable energy prices while reducing carbon pollution. Carbon pollution is the dangerous pollution that leads ultimately to climate change. So, you know, I think what's important is, you know, there are a lot of conversations happening about energy and climate policy in Washington. Most of them are debates about whether or not climate change is really a problem. But, you know, what I'm particularly excited about in terms of tonight's conversation is, you know, let's get past the politics of is climate change a problem or not, and let's focus on the solutions. Iowa is a leader You've proven that it can be done. You've proven that, the transition to clean energy economy is a good thing for the environment, but you've also proven that it can create jobs and investments. The wind industry today, costs have fallen 66%. Based on some of the policies that are currently in place, I'm hopeful that we're going to see 600,000 jobs in the wind industry alone by 2050, many of those here in Iowa.
Mm-hmm. You wanted to for your talk this evening, leave politics out of it, and I appreciate that comment, except that I'm wondering how much politics, the gridlock in Washington, the controversy over climate change, differences of opinion in Washington sort of dictate on how our country is progressing here in addressing climate change. Does this mean that it falls to states, that's more of a state patchwork of progress instead of a unified national approach?
I think you will see, a transition to the states being the real leaders when it comes to making this transition happen. That's not to say Washington hasn't played an important role in that. And I think there are two things in particular that happened just in the last year that are going to, that are coming from Washington that are going to, continue to spur the kind of transition that we're seeing with more renewables, whether that's wind, solar, geothermal, and energy efficiency as well. And those two things are, first, the tax credits. And interestingly enough, this is something, the tax credits for renewables, we finally put in place a long-term plan, and a lot of this is due to the bipartisan support and certainly Senator Grassley did and deserves a lot of credit for his role in getting a long-term extension for 5 years for renewables. And what that does is provide certainty and predictability. We expect 30 million homes in 2020 will be powered by renewables and helped by these tax credits. And then the second piece is the President Obama. It finalized for the first time ever a standard on carbon pollution from our existing coal plants today. We have all sorts of standards on our existing coal facilities for mercury, acid gases, but we had never had a standard on carbon pollution. So they finalized a standard for the first time. And states are now in the driver's seat in terms of determining how they are going to comply. So the state of Iowa is going to have to, reduce the carbon pollution from the electricity sector and develop a plan in order to meet stronger, more common sense regulations. And while they're doing that, that's going to also, have put the state in a place where they're thinking about what is the right combination of renewables, refiring with natural gas, biomass, energy efficiency, so that we can meet these more aggressive standards to protect public health and the environment.
Heather Zeichel is with us, if you've just joined us, senior fellow at the Atlantic Council, former top advisor to President Obama on clean energy and climate change. Join our conversation, 1-866-780-9100. Robert Brown with us, and I think we've cleared up those technical difficulties, professor of mechanical engineering and director of the Bioeconomy Institute at Iowa State University. He leads the development of ISU's next-generation fuel technology. Robert Brown, are you there?
I sure am. Can you hear me?
Absolutely. Crystal clear. Tell us, Robert, what points you want to make in the panel you'll be participating in later today in Des Moines.
Well, I want to make sure people understand what we mean by renewable fuels. Everybody says, well, it's wind energy or it's biofuels. But in fact, it's something more fundamental than that. It is a matter of us as societies harnessing energy flows that exist in our biosphere. These are very natural process of sunlight and wind and waves, et cetera. And this contrast with fossil fuels, which are something that are essentially buried, and we pull them out of the ground and use them. And in that process, we recognize immediately that the fossil fuels are not a renewable source. They're not a sustainable source, and that they're eventually used up. And maybe even more importantly today is, in addition to pulling energy out of the ground, we pull out various pollutants, whether it's carbon that's converted to carbon dioxide, sulfur that's converted to acid rain, nitrogen that converts to various PM2.5 emissions, particulate emissions. So we have to realize that there is a fundamental difference in these two types of energy sources. Something else I would like to emphasize is that just because a resource is renewable doesn't necessarily mean it's clean energy. It depends very much on how we utilize those resources or process those resources to determine whether they actually are going to be clean energy. Mm-hmm. I think that's a failing that we've had some in the past.
Are you talking about perhaps a specific case there, ethanol, when we can raise corn, produce ethanol out of it, but we can have so many inputs that it is not really renewable, or it's a different sort of renewable?
Well, I would say virtually every renewable resource that we use today is partially renewable. And that's easy to judge. Any time that we use a fossil energy to help us produce a renewable energy, then we're not truly a renewable resource. That falls for ethanol, that falls for wind energy and solar energy. You get into the details and you find we're still very much what I call a petroleum economy. We're using fossil energy resources to transition to these renewable. And that's where a lot of the criticism then comes in, as people can point out and say, oh, there's still carbon dioxide emissions associated with ethanol. But in fact, much of that is associated with the fossil fuels that we're using in conjunction with that production.
Mm-hmm. I was surprised to see in preparing for this show that the Iowa Environmental Council says our state's solar potential ranks fourth nationally. So we have all this talk about wind, Robert Brown, but we're in solar terms, in terms of potential, we're behind only Arizona, California, and Nevada. That strikes me as very interesting. I guess Iowa is a sunny state. We can look out today and certainly enjoy the sun, but ranking with those other states, Arizona, California, Nevada, one wouldn't necessarily think so.
Well, in fact, most renewable energy is solar energy. Wind energy is a result of thermal gradients that develop from sunlight shining on the planet. Mm-hmm. So that wind energy is solar energy. Biomass is the result of photosynthesis, plants absorbing solar energy. So if you look at a lot of these, even wave energy is a form of solar energy. So it is the primary source of renewable energy on the planet. There are a few exceptions. And certainly Iowa has exploited it in terms of both wind and biomass.
I wonder, when we talk about solar panels, the technology converting the sunlight into more usable energy, where are we in there? Do we need a breakthrough? Can you say, for instance, how much a panel converts of the actual energy hitting the panel into energy?
Well, there's the folks that do photovoltaics like to brag that we're doing better than photosynthesis because we're achieving energy efficiencies that are in excess of 10%. In some experimental systems, they can go to 10 or 20 or 30%. But what I have to point out is that the basic process of what we call charge separation that occurs in a photovoltaic cell is only about 10% efficient or 20% efficient. And in a plant, that same charge of separation is about 90%. So why is it that plants are said to be so inefficient that a plant growing is only 1% or 2% efficient in utilizing solar energy? And the reason is plants do one additional thing. They store that solar energy mm-hmm. in the form of starch or sugars or proteins or lipids, whereas we haven't figured out how to do that in photovoltaics. All we can do is get the charge separation that lets us have an electric current flow. We have not figured out how to store photoelectric energy.
Mm, okay, so that is where a breakthrough needs to happen. With you, Heather, working as a top advisor for President Obama, did you see that as the largest challenge as well?
Certainly. I mean, I think to the professor's point, all of the renewables that we are bringing onto the grid, all of the new potential that we need to tap in order to meet the greenhouse gas emissions reduction targets that the science tells us we need to meet, one major missing piece of the technological picture is storage. And that's not to say that there aren't a lot of great minds, universities, and both private sector and federal dollars going into research and development in this space. And, you know, you're seeing a lot, you are seeing slow, and I'm sure the professor can speak to this actually better than I can, but you are seeing advances in the technology. But, you know, I think we see that today as, you know, that's one of the key areas where we need to continue to, you know, focus our research, focus our innovative opportunities and try and address and find that breakthrough technology that's going to help with the storage component. And that's, you know, primarily because the wind doesn't blow every day and the sun is not shining at all the time. And so, you know, the reason storage is so important is so that we can, you know, fully utilize our renewable resources, but address the intermittency of renewables.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to our caller, Matt, listening in Cascade. Matt, I see on my screen that you have installed some solar panels. Is this in your house?
Yes, we actually built a home. We started last fall and completed it, and we have 18 panels on our system, a 7-kilowatt-hour system. And, you know, one of our big concerns when building this was storage overnight. We are grid-tied, but just like your guests are talking about, if there was a way to bridge the gap from the 5 o'clock in the wintertime until 6 o'clock the next morning, it would be fantastic.
Mm. Robert Brown, can you address that?
Oh, I have to agree wholeheartedly. I haven't made that investment in solar voltaic cells for that very reason. You're still dependent very much on the grid, and I think we need to be looking at the technologies that allow us to get beyond that. Now, there are some parts of the country where you can say the amount of time the sun's shining is great enough that you could justify it. But even there, you know, nighttime eventually comes in all across the United States.
Right. And Matt, let me ask you before we say goodbye here. I, you know, we can talk about the technology and investing in it, but you are someone who's actually done it. Can you describe the feeling of getting that power drawn down from the sun and storing it in batteries within your own home?
Well, it's amazing. And that's the one thing where, you know, working with our power company, they said, you know, use as much as you can during the daytime, wash your clothes, do your dishes and whatnot. Mm-hmm. And they did say, you know, hold off on installing any kind of battery because right now they're big and they're expensive. And they talked about Tesla possibly coming out with a battery that would be for the overnight storage and using then. So, you know, right now me and my wife are just waiting to see if Tesla does indeed come out with that. And can we utilize that to bridge the gap? Because our utility bill for electric, our whole house is electric, is about $140 a month. And with the price of gas fluctuating all the time, I'll take that $140 right now and roll the dice on if Tesla can come out with something.
Okay. Thanks for sharing your experience, Matt, in Cascade. 1-866-780-9100. Let's go quickly to Troy in Iowa City. Troy, what's your question or comment?
Yes. Why don't the people who believe in, like, global warming and for solar panels and windmills, why don't they just spend the $26,000 and buy their own?
Okay.
Why make the utilities buy it? Why don't they just take the initiative and do it themselves?
Okay, let's address that question. Perhaps, Heather, you can tackle that. And I note in Troy's phrasing that he is perhaps not a believer in climate change.
Well, certainly, and Troy, it's good to hear from you. I mean, I think part of what the point I'm trying to make is that, you know, if you believe in 99% of the international scientific community that has raised the fact that climate change is a problem, the challenge here is that there's not one silver bullet solution. It's not just about a handful of people putting solar panels on their roofs. It's not just about, you know, the states of Iowa and Texas collectively being the nation's wind energy leaders. We're going to need to do a lot of different things. And the important part here, and you know, just I think Matt underscored this, is that it doesn't have to come at the expense of higher energy bills, and it doesn't have to come at the expense of, you know, fewer options for consumers. In fact, I think we're giving consumers, you know, with these options, whether that's renewables or, you know, new energy efficiency technologies like the, you know, Nest thermostat, we're giving consumers more control over where they get their energy, over how much they pay for their energy, and, you know, giving them more choice in the process.
Robert Brown, I wonder if you can address this as a professor at Iowa State University who works in this field. President Obama, in his State of the Union address just this week, talked about seeing climate change as an opportunity, a business opportunity, a technological opportunity. When will renewable energy be profitable? Is it now? When will it make good business sense without government support?
Well, it's what's clear today is it is not economical at current petroleum prices. When that changes is hard to predict. But I do have to remind people that say, gosh, we're going to be at $20 or $30 per barrel of oil for a long time. Well, it wasn't too long ago that we were at $100 a barrel.
Right.
And that change happened very quickly. So it's hard to predict what will occur. But the thing to keep in mind is we have low prices now for one simple reason. We're pumping oil a lot faster than we're consuming it. It has something to say about our economy, about the Chinese economy, about brinksmanship of Saudi Arabia in terms of trying to keep their share of the market. And these are transitory things. They're not for the long term. And I think we have to, I'm going to say something positive about politics. Politics is about collective action. You know, we gave up being rugged individualists once we got off the frontier and started saying we're going to work collectively to solve our problems, whether it's water supply or energy supply or education, et cetera. So I think politics is all about convincing people that something needs to be done. And whether we've done a super job of that is evident when we have people say, I'm not convinced. I think we have to do more to convince people that the actions we're taking are going to help build our economy rather than tear it down, are going to give more opportunities for their children and grandchildren.
Heather's like, yeah, go ahead.
Well,
Heather.
I was just going to say, I mean, I would like to take the comment regarding costs on as well. I mean, just, I know we've talked a lot about wind energy, but, you know, we are in Iowa, so it's appropriate. But wind energy costs alone have fallen 66%, and so we have to look at, well, what's the reason why? I mean, when you increase economies of scale, when you see technological improvements, you are going to be able to bring those costs down. And I think that, you know, that's an important piece of the narrative. Similar story for solar. You know, these technologies over time are becoming more and more affordable. And you know, that's incredibly important as we're thinking about, you know, what are the other energy sources and how do we make sure that we can make this transition to a clean energy economy in a way that is going to be good for consumers and American families and businesses.
Heather, we have to go to break in just a moment, but I can give you 30 seconds to respond to this question. How much of a threat, if I can put it that way, are these low crude oil prices? People don't normally say those are a threat, but to the development of renewable energy, to the direction that you advise the president on?
Well, I mean, I think, you know, put things in perspective, the fact that we're having conversations about, you know, $30 and $40 crude is something we couldn't even anticipate in, you know, 2008 or even, you know, 5 years ago for that matter. So, you know, it is true that we couldn't expect that we'd be here, but I think we have to remember the price of crude and natural gas are always going to fluctuate over time. We are going to, you know, we are going to think about our energy policy through the lens of our foreign policy.
Okay, we have to take a short break. Heather, please stay with us. Heather Zeichel with us, senior fellow at the Atlantic Council, Robert Brown of Iowa State University's Next Generation Fuel Technology, leader in that. When we come back, we'll hear about the Iowa town of Bloomfield. That's in southern Iowa. Want to be energy independent by 2030. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. And we're back midstream in this edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. We're talking about Iowa's role in a cleaner energy future for the planet. Joining us to do that, to experts who are taking part in a panel this evening in Des Moines. If you're in the Des Moines area, you might want to check this out. It sounds like a lot of fun, a discussion of the future of energy. But not only that, beer, live music presented by the Des Moines Register and the USA Today Network kicks off at 5, goes till 9 p.m. The panel discussion they're involved in takes place at 6 p.m. It's on Locust Street in Des Moines at Woolies. Heather Zeichel with us, senior fellow at the Atlantic Council, former top advisor to President Obama on clean energy and climate change. Also Robert Brown, professor of mechanical engineering, director of the Bioeconomy Institute at Iowa State University. Join our discussion, 1-866-780-9100. We're wondering if you're actively pursuing cleaner energy in your community, your household, your business. Tell us about it, 1-866-780-9100. Several good examples in our first half hour. Joining us now to bring it down to a local community level is Kevin Nordmeyer. He is not on the panel this evening. He's former director of the Iowa Energy Center, a co-owner and architect of BNIM Architects in Des Moines. And he's a team member working on the Streetscape project in Bloomfield, Iowa, which we'll hear about. Kevin Nordmeyer, welcome back to our program.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
Now, the southern Iowa town of Bloomfield, it's a population of, 2,500 people, something in that neighborhood. It's set the goal of becoming an energy-independent community by the year 2030. How did this Bloomfield project start?
Well, it's really interesting. You know, Robert mentioned at the end of the first half hour that it really takes a community or collective thinking to move agendas forward. And the town of Bloomfield has decided to do that. It started several years ago with their Bloomfield Main Street program, renovating the historic town fronts around their town square, their historic courthouse. And after that, they decided to do upper story renovations of their downtown into apartment units. And the Iowa Economic Development Authority funded the developer on those projects. Part of that requirement is to do the Green Streets criteria, which the Economic Development Authority developed several years ago, which is to build high-performance, healthy, water-resourceful projects. And so through that effort, I think they started to become more and more aware of the potential for sustainability in the community. Then they hired me and a team of folks, Conservation Design Forum as the leader of our team, landscape architecture firm, to do a streetscape project. And as we started that, we said, you know, rather than just replace this with concrete, why don't we start to think about stormwater management, pervious streetscape systems, LED lighting. And if we have the streets all torn up around the town square, why don't we think about a district geothermal heat pump system to make the downtown core more efficient? And you could then add solar to then power the pumps and so forth. And they started to just really think about this. And then the Municipal Utility Association, Iowa Association of Municipal Utilities, completed a study in 2014 then that showed that if they did efficiency first in the community and homes and then added varying levels of renewables, they could indeed be energy neutral in about 2030.
So what does energy independent or energy neutral mean exactly in this case?
That means like right now they consume, you know, X amount of kilowatt hours in that community. And so by doing efficiency first, you know, gearing up and doing a coordinated community-wide effort of making homes in the community more efficient first, so reducing that demand first is the first task. Then by adding the balance, you have a balance then of what you consume in terms of kilowatt hours. If you could then provide that by either solar or wind, it then is a complete offset. So it's neutral at that point.
Well, fascinating there. Conservation teaming up with solar, wind, even geothermal in this case. Your specific role, Kevin, in this, what is your more specific role?
There's a multidisciplinary team involved in the streetscape project. So there's landscape architects, civil engineers. I'm an architect on the team and sort of a community facilitator on the project. The energy efforts they've been doing in the community have been led by Chris Ball, who's been hired as the energy efficiency director for the community. And the city council has just really embraced the notion of helping progressively move the community forward. So a lot of the energy efficiency and renewable energy strategies they've done have been sort of grassroots on their own in town.
Mm-hmm. You're early on in this project, right?
I mean, very early, yeah.
Very early on. I don't know. I imagine they're leaders in communities listening all across Iowa and the Midwest right now saying, I wonder if this is something for our community. Can you give advice on others who might aspire in this direction, lessons learned already, even though it's an early stage?
Sure, absolutely. It requires a committed group of individuals in the community to start. In this case, it's kind of started, I believe, with the Bloomfield Main Street, you know, organization sort of as a catalyst. But then it takes a committed leadership. The city council of Bloomfield is stepping up and stepping forward to move some agendas forward. And they've got, I'm sure not everyone in the community agrees with it, but they have general consensus to move these agendas forward. But you need to start to develop a roadmap after that. So they've now established their roadmap through the study the Municipal Utility Association concluded and our streetscape design project. And so now they're just starting to knock off, these certain mileposts on this path to achieving energy independence.
Heather Zeichel, you've had the view from 30,000 feet, so to speak, as we listen to a very town of 2,500, 2,600 people here. What are your thoughts when you hear about a community changing its mindset, I assume, and really tackling this at a local level?
Well, I mean, first, I think Bloomfield and the residents and all the collective efforts that are happening there are certainly I want to congratulate you and tell you you're not alone. There are actually literally thousands of cities across the United States that are working at their own local level to not only identify what is the right target for our community in terms of reducing greenhouse gas emissions and ramping up clean power. But it's also happening in communities across the world. And, the important message here is, as I started to say earlier, there's not one solution to the climate challenge. It's going to take the collective efforts of our universities, of our state and local governments, of NGOs, of homeowners. I mean, working collectively, we can solve this challenge, but it is going to require efforts at many, many different levels. And the important thing is that work is getting underway now, and there are important rules and regulations, but also, there's a test bed of different kinds of policies and people sharing information about what works, what doesn't. And that's, really exciting to see everybody coming together with one common goal to try and find new creative solutions to tackle this challenge together.
Just over 10 minutes left of our conversation on energy independence and policy on this edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Robert Brown at Iowa State University, leading development of ISU's next generation fuel technology. I wanted to have you introduce us to at least a term that and a technology that I have never heard of, and I assume many of our listeners, something called pyrolysis is what you work with. How does this fit into the picture that we're talking about today?
Well, pyrolysis is a advanced energy conversion technology. It can be used for production of advanced biofuels or bioelectricity. It could be used to produce a variety of bio-based products, as we call them. What it essentially is the rapid heating of biomass or waste materials so that they break down and produce a variety of chemicals. One of the things that we're trying to do is being able to sort out those chemicals, if you will, so that there is essentially one that would go to production of transportation fuels, another would be production of what we call bioasphalt, another would be for a production of biocement or non-corrosive de-icers. So the idea is to produce more than just fuels, but to produce a variety of products. And this is what we call a biorefinery. In the case of pyrolysis, we call it a pie refinery.
Mm-hmm. Let's go back to our callers. Francis is joining us from Fairfield, Iowa. Francis, welcome to our program.
Hi, thank you. Dr. Brown, I was going to follow up on the pyrolysis. Can you speak more about use of perennial crops for pyrolysis, and particularly on a farm level? So if we had perennial crops, we could avoid the nitrate problem and the erosion problems and some other environmental problems.
I love perennial crops. It was the basis of the original ecosystems in Iowa, things like switchgrass and Indian grass, et cetera. It has a lot of environmental improvements, partly because it is perennial. In other words, it's got a permanent root system that helps hold the soil, helps build soil carbon, helps hold nutrients. And so if you harvest off a system like that, you are more likely to be able to have a sustainable agricultural practice. I'm not saying that's not possible with, for example, corn agriculture, but we need to think very carefully how we do it with corn agriculture in terms of can we take off both the grain as well as some of the corn stalks as an energy crop. And there are people that are working on those problems, and they keep in mind at all times is how can we not only do this to produce economic gain for a farmer to produce energy products, but to be able to do this in a sustainable fashion. What we're looking at is taking these grasses, if you will, and converting them into various products. And what a lot of people don't realize is although that perennial crop doesn't have a sugar or starch component to it, it has what we call lignocellulose, and it actually contains a lot of glucose molecules all stuck together in something we call cellulose. And we're looking at ways that we can use pyrolysis to break it down and release those sugar molecules so that it could be used as an alternative, for example, to cornstarch, for example. And this helps address some people have concerns about if you divert corn grain to an ethanol plant, are you causing food competition issues? I think the problem is much more complicated than a yes or no answer to that. But certainly if you can move to some of these non-food types of materials like switchgrass or other perennials, you can address that problem very easily.
Robert Brown, before we get to the end of the hour, I wanted to have you at least quickly mention any other technologies or avenues that we can pursue in the pursuit of energy independence in this country?
Well, one I think very few people have heard about is what I'm going to refer to as carbon negative energy. And this addresses our current paradigm, which is if we want to produce energy, if we want to have economic development, we have to release carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. You can't think of a process that we do today that does not reduce some level of carbon dioxide, and that includes production of grain ethanol fuels, et cetera. And so people think if we give up on carbon dioxide emissions, we give up on economic development. We want to turn that paradigm on its head and say, let's actually produce energy and have economic development by taking CO2 out of the atmosphere. Now, some people might say, gosh, that sounds like a violation of the second law of thermodynamics or something like that. Well, I teach thermodynamics, and I assure you it is not. In fact, virtually every ecosystem on this planet operates on the basis of a carbon negative energy. And it is possible through the role of photosynthesis being able to simultaneously have energy absorbed by a plant, which then at the same time is absorbing carbon dioxide, and converting that carbon dioxide into cellulose, sugars, etc. And if you then take that biomass and partition it between some of it you use for energy and emit CO2, but part of it you sequester as carbon, then you can achieve what we call carbon negative. We have a net result of reducing the amount of CO2 that is actually in the atmosphere as we produce energy, as we build our economy. And we're looking at developing the technology to do that. And that is, again, based on pyrolysis. The carbon sequestration agent we produce is called biochar. If you look at it, you'll say, well, that just looks like charcoal. Well, indeed, that's what it is. We refer to it as biochar because of the ecosystem services that we can produce by using it as a carbon sequestration source in our soils. It actually builds soil carbon.
Mm-hmm. Heather Zeichel, comment on this because we talked about the political aspect a little bit earlier in the hour. But one of the chief headwinds when we talk about addressing climate change is that people will say, yes, but it's I'm not going to make that decision if I'm a politician. This is a political year. I'm not going to make that decision in favor of these technologies. It's at the cost of the economy and jobs. And here we're hearing from Robert, that's not really the choice that we face.
Right. I mean, look, I think that it is true there are a lot of naysayers out there, and they have set up this false choice that you can't have, economic growth with a healthy, robust, strong environment. And I think if you look at and talk to the people in Bloomfield that have committed to this, clean energy future, if you just look at the state of Iowa, Clearly, that is not the case. I mean, they have been able to, become a national wind energy leader, grow their wind portfolio, keep energy costs affordable, and in that process, create a lot of create many, many jobs. And you know, again, if you just look at the policies that are in place today, we are projecting that you'll have 600,000 jobs in the wind industry alone by 2050. So I think there's certainly a lot of, I think everybody, certainly in Iowa, is very aware that there's a lot of political rhetoric, but that doesn't necessarily match reality.
When we talk, Kevin Nordmeyer, back to you, involved in Bloomfield, in this community in southern Iowa that wants to become energy independent in the, by 2030. I wonder, in working there, have you changed people's minds? Has there been a collective mindset change that people who are normally consuming, I guess, national media, and they're working now with people who are fully informed about this? Do you see a change of mindset?
Yeah, I mean, the times that I've been there at community forums and so forth, it really is. It's just their attitude has been, rather than ask why not ask why not, you know. Mm-hmm. And so they've really just taken a proactive approach to just taking incremental steps forward, heading toward the goal of being energy neutral. And it does require money, and so they've developed a portfolio of grants that they're going after and funding resources. But their council has put forward, buckets of money to fund like on-bill financing programs for homeowners and so forth. And so it's a combination of state, local, and national funding to make their system work.
Daniel is joining us. He's driving through the state, I understand. I hope safely listening and talking to us. Daniel, how are you?
Very good.
Yeah, what did you want to bring into this conversation as we end the hour?
Well, I'm in the renewable energy business, and you guys were talking about the economics of solar and wind and renewable energies versus like the conventional stuff. But if you take into consideration the huge subsidies that come about from the use of these non-renewable energies, like all the pollution control equipment and stuff, that there's tons of money spent in Washington, D.C. on subsidizing all this stuff and pollution control equipment and all through that stuff. If you took that away and put it on solar, or even half of it, it totally changes the economics of that equation. And actually, renewables are actually cheaper.
Mm-hmm. So the point you're making, Daniel, is that we're not including, we don't traditionally in our thinking include all the costs associated with burning crude oil.
That's correct. Also, the public service commissions in these states, these utilities are monopolies. And these public service commissions are supposed to protect the consumers with regulation. And over in Wisconsin, they've actually promoted the utilities to raise their base fees and reduce the energy costs so that the renewable energies are – the payback is not there even to do it. And they actually are fighting the renewable energy. They pretend like they're in favor of it, but the utilities and monopolies are trying to minimize the impact of these things, kind of like the gas-alcohol thing. Mm-hmm. Well, they limit it to 10%. You know,
Daniel, it sounds like you serve a number of states. We mentioned at the outset, and I don't know if you were with us, that the states are more or less going are leaders at this point because of things happening in Washington. Do you find that to be the case if you're dealing with several states, that you can have ahead, some states behind in this pursuit?
That's true, but you have to look at the whole picture, and what's happening in Washington, D.C. is a big money behind this stuff that's all protecting these monopolies, and the public service commissions need to take a look at themselves and start protecting the consumers. If you don't need the monopolies anymore, maybe we should get rid of them.
Daniel, thank you very much for listening and for contributing to our program. We have just a minute or two wrapping up here. I wanted to give you each less than a minute to kind of say anything that you haven't yet or just comment on what we just heard there. Heather, please.
Well, you know, look, I would just first again thank you for the opportunity to join you, and if I were to summarize the opportunity
quickly,
that we have, look at the benefits: energy independence, job creation, And if we are not leaders in this, there are 194 other countries who have committed to put themselves on a path to a cleaner energy economy. We do not want to lose that opportunity to create those energy sources, create those jobs, and export those resources.
Okay, Robert Brown, what is on your mind as we end this hour?
Well, I would like to see the United States a leader in renewable energy. There will be many opportunities in the future. It's going to be an international opportunity. I'd hate to see us lose out in that area.
Okay. And Kevin Nordmeyer, something makes me think for sure that we'll be checking back with the town of Bloomfield and see how it progresses in the few years. What are you seeing there in the next few years?
I would like to see other communities across Iowa and the nation, as Heather mentioned, continue to realize that there are steps you can take to achieve these results. And you can do it community by community. You can do it by neighborhood, district by district, and it can be done.
Okay. In terms of resources, people taking the very first steps, can you point to a place online where you find good resources?
Sure. In terms of financial resources and incentives, there's a website that's called DSIRE USA.org. It's a website from North Carolina State University that goes state by state and lists all the tax credits and resources available to folks for these kinds of things.
Repeat that, please.
DSIREUSA.org. And then regarding architecture, there's architecture2030.org. So architecture2030.org. They also list strategies that businesses can and homeowners can utilize.
Kevin Nordmeyer, thank you very much, as well as thanks to Heather Zeichel and Robert Brown. It's been fascinating. I want to mention that Heather and Robert are taking part in a panel discussion at Woolies starting at 6 p.m. Doors are open at 5. There's not only a discussion of the future of energy, but beer and live music. Heather and Robert, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
And Kevin, of course, as well.
Thank you.
River to River is produced by Claire Roth, Emily Woodbury, and Lindsay Moon. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. It's a NewsBuzz edition tomorrow on the program. Hope you'll join us. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us for this show.